Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is David Gessner, and he's the author of 13 books that blend a love of nature, humor, memoir, and environmentalism, including the New York Times bestselling All the Wild That Remains. Gessner is a professor at the University of North Carolina in Wilmington, where he also founded the literary magazine Ecotone. His own magazine publications include pieces in the New York Times Magazine, Outside, Orion, and many other magazines. In 2017, he hosted the National Geographic Explorer show, The Call of the Wild. And the book that we're talking about today is The Book of Flaco, The World's Most Famous Bird. And did I pronounce everything correctly?
Flaco and Ecotone.
Okay, Flaco and Ecotone.
We had an opening for Ecotone years ago, and I had the whole, at the time it was around where David Letterman was doing his Oscar speech, and I had everyone go, Ecotone, not Ecotone. so I'm used to correcting that.
Okay. So welcome to Writer's Voices, David.
Thank you very much, Monica.
So for those who might not know, because although Flaco might be the world's most famous bird, I live in the Midwest. He wasn't all that famous here.
Right.
So tell us who Flaco was.
Flaco was a Eurasian eagle owl, which is the largest owl competitive with one other owl species that is native to Europe, Russia, some North Africa. And he was born in North Carolina, not native to the United States. And at 1 year old, he was moved up to the New York Central Park Zoo, where he spent the next 12 and a half years. On the night of February 2nd, 2023, some people who've been variously labeled as vandals and liberators cut a hole in his small cage, and he popped through and started flying down Fifth Avenue. By the next morning, he had 100 birders or so and some media people watching him as he perched in the Hallett Sanctuary in Central Park. And over the next months, he developed not just a local following, but an online following where people in Hong Kong and, and Scotland were watching him through video as he grew. Early on, Flaco was the Central Park Zoo attempted to capture Flaco, and people were mostly for that. But gradually, Flaco started to regain kind of his skills, the skills that evolution had taught him. And he caught big, fat rats in Central Park. And he could barely fly when he first got out, but he learned to fly. And the story just kind of took off, no doubt in part because it was in New York City. But the following ended up being worldwide. And one of the interesting things was this wasn't just an animal story. It was kind of a story about the modern media as people were constantly Skyping and tweeting, because Twitter changed halfway through the Flaco year to X, but I had a huge Twitter following. And so to me, it was pretty fascinating on a lot of levels.
Right. So have you ever written about birds before?
I have. I had a book called Return of the Osprey, which actually Cornell is going to do a 25th anniversary edition this fall. And I've written about not just ospreys in that book, but following them on their migratory track down to Cuba and Venezuela in another book called Soaring with Fidel. So I have written about birds, and that's kind of part of how the book came to be and evolved.
And also because your daughter was going to school in New York, and you wanted an excuse to go visit her a lot, it sounds like.
Exactly. As I say in the book, Flaco wasn't the only animal being tracked in New York. My wife on her phone had, could tell when how they went out to bars late at night and could follow her all. So, yeah. And oddly enough, my wife, who wrote a book called The Christie Affair that did well enough that it's part of the reason we can pay for NYU, you know, her next book is also about New York. So apparently we're not very good at letting go.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. So are there, how big was Flacco? How large a bird?
Well, probably the frame of reference for people in this country, if you've seen a great horned owl, it's a much bigger relative of that. You know, it's like, it's, I think it's Blockinson's owl is the only owl as big. So it's, you know, it's huge, basically, is the best word.
Okay, but huge, yeah. Like 18 inches tall, 3 feet tall?
Yeah, I mean, picture a raptor, you know, a big hawk, mm-hmm. and it's bulkier and heavier than a big hawk.
Okay.
It's probably the best way to think about
okay.
it.
Okay, all right. So are owls not native? I mean, obviously this owl is not native. This type of owl is not native to New York City.
Right.
But do other owls live there?
Yes, there are barred owls and there are great horned owls. And all sorts of owls that we have that are, and in fact, while I was writing the book, I had a barred owl serenading me outside my window. I'm a very early morning writer, like 4 o'clock in the morning.
A barred owl was serenading you. Did you see it?
Yes, I would go out at dark and look for it.
Because that's the thing about owls. You can often hear them, but you don't often see them.
Yeah, you have to be patient. In fact, I write a bit about that in the book. I thought it would be interesting, since we're a writing show, and I'm sure we're going to get to this anyway, but to me, I'm eager to get to it. A year ago now, today is February 6th, a year ago, I hadn't started the book yet. And so,
oh my gosh,
you have the book in your hand. So I was teaching, I just had one of my grad students from this class. I was teaching a graduate class in environmental writing, and I assigned the class an exercise that Linda Hogan, the great Native American novelist, poet, and essayist, had assigned me in grad school 30 years ago. And the exercise was basically, pick an animal, any animal, and go out and observe it and spend a week taking notes. I'm a visual artist, so I drew my great blue heron that I went to see. And I thought it's a pretty good assignment, a little bit boring, but it changed a lot for me. It's what led to me writing the Osprey books. I found myself kind of being pulled out of myself into the world of birds. So I gave my grad students this assignment probably in January a year ago. And I didn't know at the time that I would be taking my own assignment and going to extremes with it. Because I had had a casual interest in Flacco because Hadley was in New York. I'd never seen Flacco. And I just happened to be up there visiting her the day Flacco died. And so I had this, you know, I was like, okay, you know, and I looked at the outline, you know, there was a memorial for him, and I started to kind of look around at the literary landscape of Flacco, and there was a funny New Yorker piece, and there was some New York Times tributes, but I didn't see anything substantial, any long narrative, you know, creative nonfiction about Flacco. So I started to think maybe this is something I would try to do. And I knew I had to strike fast because, you know, as you said, Flacco wasn't famous everywhere and the attention would wane. So I wanted to get it out by the anniversary of Flacco's death, which is February 23rd. Mm. So first, to kind of plant my flag, I said I'm going to write a few articles for Terrain.org, a great nature journal. But I wanted to be sure first, so I called up David Barrett, who was the kind of high priest of Flaccodom. His Twitter account was where, you know, 100,000 people came to be followed it. And I asked David if he would talk to me. And he said, sure. So I flew up to New York from Wilmington, North Carolina, where I live. And I went out in the morning. It was a rainy morning in February. And he showed me the haunts, like the last places Flacco had lived.
So this was just days after Flacco had died.
Less than 2 weeks after the death, I went back to New York. And he showed me the water tower that Flacco had hooted down into the Upper West Side neighborhood in. And he was very generous with his time, you know, and he told this story of like the evolution of Flacco that intrigued me. This was the morning. And so then it was raining a little harder, and I said goodbye and thanked him. And I booked across Central Park, partly to look for a restroom, but also to look where Flacco was. And I went into the zoo and kind of poked around and tried to find the cage where Flacco had been. And I saw this maintenance guy, and I asked him where Flacco had been. But I also, Philip Roth called writing the unseemly art, right? And I also kind of pretended I didn't know anything about Flacco, so he would educate me. And we went over to the cage, and he said, this is where they must have snuck in at night to cut the cage, where the cameras are, and they must have used a grinding tool to do it. And he commented on how small the cage was. I didn't solicit that. And I looked at it, and there was a kind of a painting of the Russian steps behind that to me seemed almost haunting because the cage was so small and this big bird lived in the smaller cage. So already, after the morning, my synapses were snapping and I was like getting, the way a book starts to come to you. And I went home and took a nap in my hotel room. But while I'd been running around, I'd been texting with this woman, Nan Knighton, who was a playwright lived on Fifth Avenue. And the bird had visited her house and peered in the window with its orange eyes for 3 hours one afternoon. And Nan wasn't a birder or anything, but she'd been so fascinated by it that she said it had changed her life. Like at Thanksgiving after that, her grandkids and her daughters had looked at her kind of funny, and she asked why finally, and they said, you sure talk about that owl a lot. And she was kind of epitomized this obsession. So I went over to her house that night and had cocktails and looked out over Central Park, beautiful Fifth Avenue apartment, and she showed me the window where Flacco stared in. So basically the next morning I woke up and said, I think I'm going to write this book because there was enough, collected and enough energy. And I know how, this is book 14 for me, so I know how a book builds in you. And this was building, but at a high speed because so much had happened that first day.
Wow.
So by another week or so, I was committed. And I also knew I had to do it at a fairly blazing speed to be able to do it.
Okay.
And that was intimidating, but it was also exciting.
Okay, well, writing a book in that length of time is hard enough, but getting it actually printed and published, how did you pull that off?
Well, I assumed wrongly that my agent would be able to sell it like this, because at the time, Flaccomania had, swept the world. But and you always get these dumb comments back from editors. And probably one of the hesitations was that could I do it in that amount of time? Mm. But another was, Flacco will have faded. Mm. Luckily, that hasn't been the case. So I took it into my own hands, and I have a couple small presses. I publish with larger presses, but kind of it's like every other book sort of thing. And a couple small presses, and three of them were intensely interested. And I ended up going with Blair, who is near my home here in North Carolina, with some people that I want, a former sales guy, Michael Levitino from Norton, who I really trust and knew. And he said, we can do it. We're going to, this is when you'd have to have the draft in, in June. Then we're going to edit it fast, and you're going to have to, do all the revisions. We put together a schedule which would make it plausible. And I was teaching full time and had other projects I was working on. But, sometimes with the adrenaline, I wrote those articles really fast, and I knew that the articles contained the seed of the book. So, and I also could draw on my past experience as a nature writer, like with, you know, I watched snowy owls on Cape Cod quite a bit. And I had some old set writing from those that I knew I could work in. So, I, you know, it was crazy making, but it was also fun and exciting.
Well, if you had, if your larger press that you work with had taken it, they probably couldn't have done it in that time. It's probably
I was only going to do it if they could. So it was a fun like experience of like everything I've done before at a super fast accelerated level.
You know, right at the you talk about this visit, the owl visiting Nan, and it landed on what, an air conditioner or something outside?
Yeah, it landed on her window. On her, I think she's on the 13th floor and just peered in.
Oh, her windowsill. Okay. So I just want to share, and I know that the listeners aren't going to be able to see this, but at the I'll show you the picture. At the beginning or in September of 2020, so this is during lockdown, I'm working from home. Everything's very weird, you know, because everything had changed in that in those few months. And I'm sitting at my desk working, and all of a sudden I see, let's see, I've got to share my screen with you. I see, can you see it?
Yeah, wow.
Right, like outside
immature,
my window.
Immature red tail, maybe?
It's a young shin tail, I think.
Sharp-shinned, maybe?
Yeah. Because I looked it, and that's what I found. And so it's a hawk. It's a young hawk, and it's sitting right outside my window. Now, you can see in the background, I've got a lot of cedar trees back there that provide, and there's always birds in those trees. But wonderful. And it provides a lot of cover for animals and so forth. And I'm not in the country. I'm actually in town, but at the edge of a small town. So anyway, I thought you'd enjoy seeing my unusual bird visitor.
Well, that's really relevant to the book because, you know, there are birders, hardcore birders that make up some of the characters in the book. But interesting to me is, you know, just casual or non-birders who are visited by the bird. And I really feel like my experience writing about ospreys, which really was what allowed me to do this book so quickly, is having done a slower, deeper book before, but was that there's something about birds and the moments and the surprise of it and the wildness of it that lifts you kind of out of yourself. And it's just so, you know, you don't have to be an expert to experience that. And that's one of the key points of the Flacco story. He delighted and kind of thrilled all these people who weren't usually used to, you know, being nature people, basically.
Right. Now, what would you want readers to, the main thing to take away from this book?
I think a little bit what I just said, that that these moments of, you know, we are in difficult times, obviously, and we're in virtual times. You know, here we are talking on screens right now, and that there are still wild possibilities in the world. There are still moments of surprise, and those often involve not our screens or ourselves, but animals beyond us. And, you know, that there's kind of biocentric way of thinking is, rather than an anthropocentric way of thinking, is to see the world beyond the human. And to me, Flacco, for all his media superstardom and, you know, Lady Di type tragedy and all that, was an opening into a different world and a different life. And actually, the readings I'm going to do are a little bit about that, about how it's not anthropomorphizing to say that this bird had moods and enjoyments and an interesting life. And so that's a big part of the book is that. And also just, you know, that caring a little bit for creatures that aren't human beings is a big part of it.
So that you have a You mentioned the snowy owls that you had watched on Cape Cod, and there was a word that you used regarding those snowy owls, which I was,
Eruption.
yeah, I, yeah, how do you pronounce it?
Just like eruption, but it's with an I instead of an E.
Yeah, and I, so it's IRRUPTION. And so what is an eruption?
Periodically, snowy owls, which are in the Arctic, I believe it's because of a boom in their main food source, which are lemmings. They end up occasionally heading farther south. And in recent years, we've had a couple big ones where suddenly snowy owls are appearing not just on Cape Cod, but much farther south. New York is another place, like the Midwest. And so you have this unusual, startlingly beautiful white bird just appearing. Often, it's always in winter, so if you're lucky, you get it with snow as well as snowies, and that's another one of those kind of wild eye-opening moments.
Oh, wow. Now, why would it in a boom in their food source cause them to
That's
move?
a good question. Because I believe they do better. And they reproduce more, and then they're overpopulated. Now, there's going to be some scientist who listens to the show and says he's totally wrong, but I think that's what it is.
It makes
Hey,
sense.
can I say one more kind of writing
Sure.
inside baseball type thing,
Of course.
which is so I mentioned that I did that exercise long ago with Linda Hogan, and I was mostly writing fiction then, and I was writing some essays. But I wrote an essay called Sick of Nature, which was I'd had two books come out, and I was really tired of being called a nature writer. It seemed belittling. I was writing about life and great themes. And yes, there was an occasional tree and bird or squirrel in it, but I wasn't a nature writer. So I think it begins like, I am sick of nature. I am sick of trees. I am sick of the ocean. And the kind of punchline was that an editor for Algonquin Press read the essay where it was published and then asked me to do a nature book. So it was, and so I that's how I ended up doing Return of the Osprey. She said, "You write so beautifully about birds, and could you write a book about birds?" And I thought, oh, I don't want to do a book about semi-palmated plovers or titmice or some little, I don't know, fancy book. And then I remembered that ospreys, I was living on Cape Cod, that ospreys had not been there during my childhood. They'd been wiped out by DDT. And suddenly these big soaring birds with 6-foot wingspans were back everywhere on Cape Cod. So I said I could write a book about ospreys. And so she did an amazing thing, which I had never experienced before. She gave me an advance, not very much. Maybe it was like 12,000, 6,000 up front and then 6,000 later. But it was enough to quit my job at the bookstore. And what I did was I went out on the marsh. I picked out four nests, one near my dad's grave at this beautiful cemetery on Cape Cod, one across from my house, one way in the woods. And I went to them. That was my job. And I'd go to them with my telescope and I'd watch as the ospreys came back and rebuilt the nest, as they laid their eggs, as the young hatched and slowly tried to learn how to fly. And it was very, very boring at times, I'll be honest. But my mentor, this kind of my Obi-Wan Kenobi of osprey, says, you've got to learn to live on osprey time. And so I tried to slow myself down, and I watched the birds all through the year until they left and flew to South America in September. And all through the year, I kept journal notes, and I wrote and wrote, but I didn't start the book because it didn't make, unlike Flacco, I wasn't in a great rush, but it also didn't make sense until I'd seen the whole nesting season. And when they left, it was like a starting gun went off, and I wrote a draft of the book in less than a month, where I just basically, was in my sweats and didn't shower, and just all I did was type and drink coffee.
Starting at
But I
4 in the
wrote
morning.
starting at 4 in the morning, and I And I wrote and wrote and wrote this thing. And then, you know, thought it was genius sometimes, thought it was terrible other times, and sent it to my editor. And she sent it back. And, you know, she was very helpful and great. But, you know, then I rewrote it over a couple months. But basically that method of work, which is to collect and adventure and gather and gather, has stayed with me. And then once you've reached that point, kind of have held all those words in to blast the words. And I bring that up in part because a smaller version of that was how Flocko was written. You know, obviously accelerated, but there was the gathering, you know, the whole time you're gathering and you're not writing, in the back of your brain, you're already writing, right? You're already starting to imagine it and the form of it. And so, so for me, Return of the Osprey was kind of a pivotal book because it taught me that the two things I love about writing most, one is being at the desk and typing and being immersed, but the other are these adventures that often precede that. You know, like, and I found more and more that with nonfiction, those adventures, it's like you're a character in your own story. It's a lot of fun.
And in your books, you actually, you do put yourself in the books a lot.
Yeah. I do. Well, it depends on the book a little bit.
Okay. Well, it's in Flocko, you're certainly in Flocko. And so part about Flocko and it's part memoir and it's part about birding and the conflicts between serious birders and people who are just out looking at birds for fun. You know, there's some history and there's some science and there's, you know, a little bit of everything.
And there's me, as you pointed out. Yeah. And structurally, you know, of course, immediately I faced the challenge of the fact I had not seen Flocko. And I reasoned that Tom Wolfe never went to outer space to write the right stuff. And, you know, and I could go back and interview and see footage. But that influenced the structure of the book because the present tense narrative starts around this time last year where I am the detective trying to figure things out. And the past tense narrative starts when Flocko actually breaks out of his cage. So those two tenses and stories intertwine, I guess.
And it sounds like, I mean, you talk to a lot of people who did see Flocko or really followed Flocko, really cared about Flocko. It sounded like everybody, was there anyone that wasn't willing to talk to you? Because it sounded like a lot of people were.
Yes. The zoo wasn't willing to talk to you. The zoo didn't talk to anybody. You know, and that actually, you know, I write about that in the book. That was kind of, I think, a mistake on their part because they lost control of the narrative. And, you know, they could have done what David Barrett did, which was, you know, guide people and educate them about eagle owls. So it could have been a moving zoo, basically.
I don't think
they're going to like me very much when the book comes out, but I think that I tried to be fair to them, but they probably won't.
Yeah, you don't paint them as, you know, as bad.
Yeah.
You know, they did try and recapture Flocko, but not in a harsh way. They never, you know, it didn't seem like they, because they probably could have if they had really.
Yeah.
Been not cared about the impact on him.
Yeah. And then, you know, and then the kind of whole, you know, the whole world was suddenly wanting a free Flocko. So that put them in a tough spot. They were in a no-win situation, basically.
Yeah. Well, David, why don't you read a little bit from the book of Flocko?
I'll do that. I'll read a couple short passages, and then if you think we have time, there's like a one page thing I read. You just whatever you decide.
Okay.
So the first passage is, I mentioned I visited him in his cage, and it's about you know, and I was struck by how small it was, and he wasn't really able to fly, but also I was thinking about how we anthropomorphize animals and what's good about that and what's not good. So I'll start in. For most of the 20th century, human beings who studied animals and human beings who used words to describe them were warned not to attribute human emotions to animals. Anthropomorphism, the great crime. Only lately has common sense and empathy, bolstered by emerging science, returned to the scene and told us what we knew already. To say an animal is experiencing a certain feeling is not plastering a human emotion on an inhuman thing. It is allowing for the obvious but somehow suppressed fact that we co-evolved with creatures like owls for billions of years before splitting off and going our human way. No grand experiments are needed to conclude that emotion is part of our common heritage. Just watch a big cat prowl back and forth in the zoo. Just ask your dog if it wants to go for a walk. So maybe bored is not the exact word, but something close. Our fellow animal, Flacco, lives a life where many of the things that have been encoded in him by the grand scheme of evolution have been denied. Not small things either. Sex, food obtained by hunting, flight, soaring, companionship. Zoo-goers sometimes complain about the bird. One day a man tells a zoo worker that the bird looks grumpy. Perhaps a more worthwhile experiment than questioning the use of anthropomorphism would be to separate this man from his children and place him in an enclosure for 12 years and see how he fares, whether or not he too would exhibit some grumpiness. This is how life is for Flacco and how life will be forever. If Flacco doesn't know it in his mind, he feels it in his bones, things will never change. And then one night they do. Who knows what was in the minds of those who brought about this change, which for the bird will be monumental. Maybe it was two PhDs from nearby Columbia who had spent the night before drinking coffee and arguing about the ethics of animal imprisonment, synapses sparking while touching on some of the issues discussed above. Maybe just two drunk kids. Or maybe it was a soul emancipator, a heroic loner with a love for birds. An act of vandalism, it was called, and vandalism it might have been. Emancipation works too. How long did it take for Flacco to notice that something had changed? How long did it take to approach this change thing? He would have no idea at first what this meant, but perhaps soon enough, after the interlopers, his liberators, it would turn out, left, he flew to a lower branch to see what there was to see. Hopped further out on the branch in an awkward, graceful way that would make later observers smile. What he found was an opening. A spot where the mesh was cut and bent back, circular, not too much bigger than an owl. It wouldn't have seemed at first what it would end up being, a portal to another world. Curious, the owl perhaps turned his head, inspecting in that manner that has led human beings through the centuries to call his kind wise. And curiosity, another shared trait between his kind and ours, would have finally led him to step or fly hop through the portal. To have been in a cage for 12 years, to not be in a cage. So that's early on. And then, as we talked about, at first, the zoo tried to capture Flacco, and part of that was because it didn't look like he could fend for himself. He couldn't fly.
He'd never hunted.
Exactly. I mean, he could fly a little. He hadn't hunted, you know, and then miraculously, I think the first thing that observers saw was him coughing up a pellet, which meant he had eaten. But then suddenly he was observed catching a rat, and this was a big breakthrough. And then he started getting better at things, and his skills improved. And I'll start here. Flacco developed those skills the way most of us do, slowly, by accretion, but then also suddenly jumping forward. As his skills expanded, so did his horizons. The North Woods, the Ramble, the Sheep Meadow, the Lock, the Harlem Mere, all of these spots in Central Park. Darker stories would later be told in the wake of the grim autopsy report, with at least some of the early warnings proving true. But what we forget when we render these retrospective judgments is the sheer thrill of those first days. They were days of growth, of change, of evolution. And while it might be dangerous to attribute specific emotions to an animal, it is fair to say that on a physical level, at least, a kind of self-realization was occurring. Certainly, Flacco was becoming more. Parts of him that had long slumbered were waking up. Would it be going too far to say that as he got stronger, Flacco took some pleasure in flight? Maybe. But in When Elephants Weep, Jeffrey Mason speculates that animals feel functionlust, a German word meaning the pleasure taken in what one can do best. It must have been a release to fly without restrictions, to travel more than the length of a department store display window through the air. Many commentators would use the word freedom to describe Flacco's experience. But as recent political trends have taught us, freedom is a slippery word. Space is less abstract, and space is what Flacco now had. I love a broad margin to my life, Thoreau said. Perhaps owls do too. So those are that's probably enough reading. I got one other little thing.
All right. Well, maybe we might go ahead and do that, have you read that later on.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah, great. So tell us about some of the people that you met and wrote about in the book.
Well, probably the one I've stayed most in touch with is Nan Knighton, the playwright who I mentioned, who just from the beginning was just so delightful. And as I say, not a birder, but somebody who felt Flacco had, woke up that morning at 4 a.m. and said, something's going on here. This bird has changed something in me. So that was great. And, and having cocktails on the first night didn't hurt our friendship. David Barrett was kind of different. He, he was super knowledgeable, super smart, kind of this, went to Harvard and then studied math and went to MIT and then kind of took those tools and used them on the stock market. And then later took those same kind of analytics tools and used them for birding. He hadn't been a birder. He started slowly and late, but then he, really smart guy, suddenly was, in 1 year, I think, saw more birds in Central Park than, or in New York than anybody had. And there was a very generous and kind with his time, but there was a slight Mr. Spock feel to him, just kind of scientific, sharp. And that was great. And he read my early stuff and corrected a lot of things. And I really couldn't have written the book without him. I met Alan Drogan, who was a birder also, and who lived in the building where Flacco, finally ended up dying, fell from a roost. He, as the necropsy showed later on, had significant amounts of rodenticide, a rat poison from eating New York rats in his system, and also pigeon herpes virus, which was from eating pigeons, which he used to kind of vary his diet later on. And this weakened him and he fell. So Alan showed me the spot where Flacco had died. And then a great one was Edmund Barry, who was this birder who saw him the very first night and followed him and said, I couldn't stop watching him. I couldn't leave, which was pretty much how a lot of New Yorkers felt by the end. They couldn't stop. And I met Edmund. I knew about Edmund. I researched him. But one day I decided I would walk through Central Park in the dark from the south end all the way to the north, kind of experience it like, Flacco's places and like an owl. And I didn't see anybody. I saw one homeless guy on a bench, but I didn't see anybody for the first hour of my walk. And deep in the ramble, which is the wildest part of Central Park, I saw this guy coming toward me with binoculars like my binoculars. Mine have duct tape on them, but his were the same sort. And I went up and said, are you a birder? It was a little, it was still kind of dark. So it was a little weird to have this encounter. And I said, "Do you know Flacco?" And he said, "Yes." And it turned out it was Edmund Barry, who I'd been wanting to interview. So I was thinking, this is what happens when you get obsessed with something, right? It's the John Muir line. When you pick up one thing in the universe, you find it hitched to everything else. And when you get obsessed, these weird coincidences that you never write about in fiction start to happen. But there he was. And we start talking, and he tells me all about the first couple nights. So it was that kind of thing where everybody was super generous, and everybody shared their time and their stories. And later I did a Zoom call where I had people from all over the world chime in about what it was like to follow Flacco virtually. And finally, I have to mention, I have a whole chapter on Anka Frohlich, who originally is from Germany, who was a photographer who just got really obsessed with Flacco. And even, you know, she would go into Central Park alone sometimes late at night following the bird, aware of the danger, but also just couldn't get enough of Flacco. And so followed the bird all through the year.
Wow. So, you know, so Flacco died from these rat poisoning and virus most likely, but there's must be other birds in the city who are eating these rats.
Correct. Yeah.
So any thoughts about why it had such an impact on him?
Yeah. Other birds die. And not just birds in New York City, birds where you are, birds throughout, rat poison is used pretty liberally. And one of the, you know, I guess positives, I mean, there's a Rachel Carson aspect to the Flacco story, because at least a couple neighborhoods in New York now are experimenting with rat contraceptives, which sounds weird, but it's like basically little pills in balls and stuff rats like to eat, and it sterilizes them. And just
when you said that, my thought went to my mind went to little rat condoms.
Yeah, and I actually use the word rubbers, but I use that in the book. So, but what rat poison does, you know, it's like Rachel Carson writing about DDT. It seeps into the water. You know, it's killed pets. I understand why. My daughter's in New York. I've seen plenty of rats, but on the other hand, so Flacco is mentioned in the law they're trying to pass to ban it. And also Flacco is, his name is used in the Building Safety Bird Act. You know, a billion birds a year are killed flying into buildings. Now, in all the early stories, a billion.
In the world.
Yeah. But, okay. But like over 100,000 in New York.
Wow.
And one of the persistent falsehoods of the Flacco story was that he died flying into a building. That was in all the media early on. In fact, he was in kind of a courtyard area, and he was, you know, that's what migrating birds do. They, you know, they fly in, they see the lights, they see the reflection, and they fly into. Flacco wasn't migrating. He was an owl who knew his area really well. What he was perched and had those poisons inside him and fell, hit a video camera on the way down and hit the ground. And the contusions from the fall are what led people to mistake it as a bird collision. However, even though that's wrong, the Flacco Act has led to, you know, helping try to make buildings more bird safe. So we can handle the myth or the falsehood, because it's had a good result.
What do you do to make them safer?
Turn off the lights at night, certain like strip patterns on windows, you know, that make it clear that it's an obstacle. And there's other building, there are other things that can be done, but that's basically what you do.
Wow. You mentioned the ramble as the wildest part of Central Park, and I was fascinated by what you wrote in the book about how that came to be.
Yeah, it's not, I don't go too much into it, But basically, I'll try to find the spot here. I quote Mary Wynne from Red Tails in Love, another her book about Central Park. And the Ramble was not created to be a wild spot. It was because of disuse and you know, not caring for the park that grew up into this amazing wild area.
So tell us a little bit about the disputes among groups of birders.
Well, I think it's, you know, I guess in a kind of crude fashion, I compared it to the movie Caddyshack, where you have the judge played by Ted Knight, who's the kind of country club snob. And then you have Rodney Dangerfield as the everyman slob. And so it's not really like that. But basically, I did feel there was an aspect where the birders, the real hardcore birders, were like, no, this is how you do it. You can't do that, you fools. And then the every person birders who were in there did make mistakes. You know, they got too close to the birds sometimes, and they basically mobbed them the way crows mob birds sometimes, but overall were pretty well behaved. And it was, in the end, I understood. I'm probably more on the side of, you know, solitary nature guy who likes to go out there and be on my own. But I had a lot of sympathy with the groups. And I thought, wow, this is an interesting way. What David Barrett, kind of their leader, had done is a really educational and interesting way to get people involved and interested in the natural world and birds. So I tried to empathize with both sides on kind of schism.
Right. So the kind of elitist birders didn't want so many people.
Right. But hypocritically, they also wanted to see Flocko themselves.
Yeah. So,
I mean, there used to be a big kind of stigma about revealing the location of a daytime owl, because you wanted, that's when it's sleeping, right? You didn't want to. And the thing is, as I said, kind of in defense of David Barrett, the genie was already out of the bottle. You know, people were posting where things were. And actually, probably some of the fancy pants birders took advantage of those posts as well. So it was a little messy. It was a little messier than good versus bad.
So do serious birders have the lifetime list, or they look down on the life, like on people who are checking off the boxes of birds?
No, they twitchers in England, they're called. There's plenty of, not every hardcore birder cares about their life list that much, but most of them do. You know, most of them want to have. I mean, it's fun. You know, but it's also like any kind of inbred society.
Yeah. So now there's an epilogue in the book as well. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, one thing I told those grad students when I was giving them the exercise about following an animal was the interesting thing about this is it could lead you anywhere. Where it led me was to Finland. I had, you know, I'd written the book basically, and then finally exhausted in maybe late June, July, I thought I really do need to see a Eurasian eagle owl in the wild. As it happened, strangely, a Finnish nature writer had visited me a month before, who'd read my books, and great guy, Juha is his name. And meanwhile, I went back to my Osprey mentor, Alan Poole, and said, where can I see a Eurasian eagle owl? And two of the names he gave me of experts were in Finland. So I called Juha up and said, hey, I'm coming over. And he said, well, I've got a couple people that, you know, I can put you in touch with these kind of Gandalf-like older owl experts. So I went over you know, like everybody else in Finland, Juha had a nice sauna in his basement, and we went for a swim, had a sauna, and the next day we went out west in Finland, and this guy showed us, took us up to a cliff. And of course, the whole time I'm like, am I going to be here a week and not see an eagle owl? And as we were walking in, a young eagle owl flew by, and I was like, I'm not going to go O for Finland. I felt good. And then we climbed up the cliff and saw this big owl with glowing orange eyes from up close, and saw it diving. And at the end of the night, it dove down 100 feet down into the valley. And my friend got a picture. And what it was diving for was to scare away a lynx. So by that, it was just like that. It was just that I was like, okay, here it is, you know. And then the rest of the week was the same thing. I saw owls in an urban setting in one of the islands off of Helsinki. Just it was a great week. I mean, I could have written a book just about that week.
So. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. What do you think that you would have done differently if you were the zoo?
It would be tough. I mean, in any you know, we're so used to, well, other than current administration, we're just used to caution often from our, you know, official people. And they no doubt were being counseled to be cautious, either for legal or other reasons or just public relations reasons. And once the story kind of, you know, once it was clear they were going to let Flacco, not capture Flacco, they didn't communicate much. They said they were going to kind of monitor him. So let's just say in a fantasy world, some innovative, brilliant zoo executive says, but if instead we get involved in the tweeting out of some locations, what if we have a zoo guy, knowledgeable zoo guy out there with them who, you know, an ornithologist
could answer questions.
Who could answer questions and say, no, don't get that close, people. And what if they, which is basically the mission of a zoo, right, is to entertain and educate.
Right.
And what if we help turn people on to this, you know, adventure in the urban wild? So, and maybe that's a fantasy. Maybe they couldn't do that. But I don't see why they couldn't have, you know, at least had a plant in there of somebody who knew more about owls and became part of the story rather than stepping away from it.
Now, in the book, you have how many pages of photographs, full color photographs?
I think there's like 32 of them, and they're from
a variety of different people.
The night of his escape to the trying to capture him to the people looking up at him. One great one by Anka Frolik of the bird flying. And then, you know, and there's also a couple of them near the end by David Barrett perched up on top of the water towers.
And then you also have some from Finland as well, from the eagle owls that you saw in Finland.
By Heikki Ruomo, the great Finnish photographer who was one of the people who led our trip.
Wow.
This might be a good spot. My last page I wanted to read
is
from Finland. So
okay, let's do that.
Yeah. And I apologize to all the Finns listening. My pronunciation is not perfect. This is from the very beginning of the book. It's called An Afterword Before. I am standing on the edge of a granite cliff, staring up at the owl, who is not 20 feet away atop the crown of a twisting dwarf pine. He stares directly back at me with eyes that shine orange despite the dying light. I have come 4,500 miles to see this bird, a surrogate for an owl I will never see. Its cat-like ears twitch, wind ruffs the feathers on the back of its neck, and as the light dies, the black marks on its buff chest grow more distinct. You should never expect to win a staring contest with an owl. If you look at it, it will often look back. Not a glance either, a full-on stare. Owls and human beings share forward-facing eyes with binocular vision, and this commonality makes a difference in how we regard them. With them, we are face-to-face, eye-to-eye. True, we can't spin our heads fully behind us 270 degrees, but still we see ourselves in them. What I see now is what I will anthropomorphically call a judging, paternalistic look, the eyebrows slanting sternly over the blazing eyes. The owl turns away because he has had enough of me. He has other business. His three young are screeching down in the spruce trees below the cliff, a variety of sharp, querulous sounds that are all saying the same thing. Feed me. He waits, though. It is already close to 10 at night here near the top of the world, but it is not quite dark enough for hunting. We both notice when the darkness takes another gulp forward, swallowing the light. Hukaya, with its hoot-light first syllable, is the name for the bird in this land. In my land, we call it the Eurasian eagle owl, known for its great size and strength. For 6 months now, I've been reading up on this bird, studying words and pictures about it, and maybe feeling a little jealous when I talk to others about their encounters. But now it is real. Now I see it. The owl looks beautiful, but also bulky and strong. His power is obvious, power in repose. He grips the tree with talons that would not look out of place on a grizzly bear. And then suddenly he drops down off the tree, and with two strong flaps of his powerful wings, showing the white of his underwings, crosses by and then below me and down toward the valley below. A dark shape slicing through the gloaming, almost a part of the encroaching darkness, moving towards something that only he sees.
That's when
he saw the lynx, but he went after the lynx. But I thought I'd save the lynx for the end of the book.
And that was David Gessner reading from the Book of Flacco. We're out of time. We always close with the quote, and coincidentally, you just quoted John Muir a few minutes ago, and that's who I had chosen for a quote today. In every walk with nature, one receives far more than he seeks.
Wonderful.
And thank you for being with us, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you very much.